webcasting to the world.
Do you remember the moment you saw yourself and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody?
Knowing the truth about the gospel.
You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you.
That we are all righteous.
And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
That's Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Joy to the world, joy to the world, oh, joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive the King, let every heart prepare Him room, and heaven and nature sing, and heaven and nature sing.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for the 10th of December. That's right, it's the 10th of December 2015, and we're broadcasting from the home of redemptionism, where we love every train of thought visiting our station of freedom. We're coming to you from the GR Studios right here in Nashville, Tennessee, Music City, USA, where, with Ben Oakley, we say the most authentic thing about us is our capacity to create, to overcome, to endure, to transform, to love, and to be greater than our suffering. And here from Houston, Texas, is that great unteacher, the heretic of all heretics, the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, and himself a Kentucky colonel, mind you, no less than Michael L. Williams. G'day, Mike. How are you?
G'day, Barris. Yes, it's true. All of that, everything you said was true. I don't know if I've ever been able to say that on the PowerCast yet, but
there's a lot more about you that's true, but we'd lose so many listeners.
Oh, not just about me. I mean, goodness, I was talking about your comments and everything. It was all true.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's nice. What's happening in your little world, Michael?
Well, my goodness. Well, my little world is going to be really fantastic the next couple of days. My daughter and two grandchildren are flying in today.
Oh, get out of here. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, no. No, I'm just absolutely thrilled. So after PowerCast, I'll be vacuuming and doing some things, you know, that one should do.
That motherly types like you do.
Exactly. Yes, you just got to do it. And especially if you live alone and there's nobody else to do it.
You've only been there for a week. You've only lived in this house. I mean, how dirty can you be?
Oh, it's been more than a week, 2 months.
Has it been that long? Okay.
Yeah. I paid half month in September. because I'd already started moving.
Well, what's happening in the world at large, friend?
Well, we are still sharing the gospel around the world on every front. It seems as though there's something new going on every day in Kenya and in Burma. All of Africa is now in our sights now that Moses and Liz and their family are stable financially, and they've really got the entire continent of Africa in their sights.
Wow.
So a lot's going on, and we have our gospel revolutionaries to thank for that, Barris. It's the folks that have committed to these monthly contributions and people who are giving into the gospel on a regular basis that makes all of this work. It really is a powerful thing that's going on in the planet, and we really do appreciate you guys.
Well, Mike, we have over the last few weeks been dealing with the matter of antinomianism, and we've taken a sidetrack for the last several weeks on what gives antinomianism its life, and that is, of course, dualism. And so as we've been looking at dualism and researching dualism, we realize, of course, that oneism or unism or unity, as I like to call it, is the coming together of God and man in one new creation. But dualism is that which seeks to keep us apart so that there's a God out there and there's me in here, there's you over there, and there's me over here. There is you and you're black, and there's me and I'm white. There's you and you're Baptist, and me and I'm Catholic.
Yeah.
And it is that which keeps everything and everybody from touching and banging up against each other and realizing the beautiful oneness in which we all dwell. So as we've been looking at that, we've looked firstly at holy beliefs, which is what separates orthodoxy from heresy, or heretics from orthotics. We have looked at holy wars, and it doesn't matter if it's jihad with an Islamic face or the Crusades with a Christian face. It just doesn't matter. Holy wars are a direct result of dualism. Holy places. What church is holier than another? What religious Mecca is holier than another? Is Jerusalem more holy than Mecca or than, say, a Hindu place of sanctity? Is the inside of a church more holy than the outside of a church? Can I murder someone outside and have different results if I do it inside a church?
Yeah.
If I lock the door on the church and burn them all down, just kill everyone off, as has been done time after time through history, is that worse than if I lock him in a library and do it? So holy places, holy people. Is the Jewish race a holy nation? Is the Christian religion a holy nation? Is the Buddhist nations of, say, Japan or China, are there peoples who are holier than the other? And within those peoples, would certain peoples within those peoples, for example, priests, be holier than, say, lay people? Holy words we looked at last week, Mike, and that was relevant to the concept of blasphemy and what it constituted and what it was, whether it was even a reality anymore. Has sin been actually dealt with once and for all finally? And if so, how on earth could blasphemy still be a sin? So holy beliefs, holy wars, holy places, holy people, holy words, and today we're going to be covering holy acts. Now, this came to me in the original article in which I saw it as glorified suffering. And I thought, what is that except just an act that we call holy? And, of course, the first thing that came to my mind was those Easter rituals in the Philippines where people, in a desire to gain brownie points with a God who is no longer keeping score, as we would say, where they will have themselves nailed to a cross in hopes that that will get them some special dispensation with God. So that's a bit of a rewrap on our previous weeks, a little bit of a tease on our current week, what we're going to do. But before we start, I want to remind everyone that we have, or I have, I don't want to saddle everyone here, like Michael, for example. I have an outstanding reward of $1,000, which this week I'm doubling to $2,000. $2,000 says you can't show me, and nobody can show me, anywhere in the Bible where the word antinomian is found. Why is that important? Because every single one of the 40,000 schisms, sects,
yeah.
And splinter groups of Christianity claim somebody else is antinomian. In fact, really what they claim is everyone, but they are antinomian simply because they obey the law the way the law should be obeyed, and everyone else fails to do it. So I've got that reward out. If you're hungry, and I have got the money, by the way. I might not have it much longer, but I've got it. So
I'm going to start searching through my Bible right now. You know, Barris, this whole issue, and folks do, you know, goodness gracious, get your concordance out and start trying to find where this is. And we all want to see Barris give up his money here, so...
And you know I do it, Mike. I will do it. I've done it before.
Will do it. Oh, my goodness. He will do it. Yes. There's one thing for sure. My friend is a man of his word. And, you know, when I look at this whole thing of dualism, Barris, and I teach from pictures. I see pictures and I tell you what I see. I'm not that smart, but I know what a picture looks like. So. But when I see this, I see, of course, the completed fulfillment of all things and the unification, if you will, of God and man and the fulfillment of law, all of that as this beautiful woven tapestry. And when you have at one end of that tapestry, this beautifully woven tapestry, which anyone would be able to see what it is and see what the picture is. But you have a God, a holy God in heaven and a sinful man on earth. There's a tear in that tapestry on one side. When you have on the other far right side of it, of this tapestry, you have a heaven to gain and a hell to shun. There's a tear in the end of that tapestry. And all you have to do is take a tug on that, and it rips this picture right in two. This beautiful picture that has brought everything together all in one, as Paul taught so efficiently and profoundly and dedicated to it time after time that he brought this principle across to us, that the other disciples just never touched on. They just never touched on this powerful subject. And and that's why dualism and us addressing it is important, is that dualism is done as far as God and man is concerned on the spiritual level. Dualism is completely over with, but it still exists in the minds of people. So as this dualism is in the minds of people, every time we try to present this picture of this completed work of the cross, dualism begins to rip it right in two all over again. So until we are able to get rid of these two basic concepts, now everything that we're talking about, everything that we've covered, it looks like everything that we will cover, is somewhere in between these two tears, if you will. Somewhere between a holy God in heaven and a sinful man on earth, and at the end of it, a heaven to gain and a hell to shun. Those are the maximas of dualism in this picture. Until we close those ends up, there's no need in going through the middle of all of this, because we can go through and show you, and this is it. Fairly indisputable, as far as I can tell, the things that we've presented to folks. But if you still have in your mind that there's a holy God in heaven and a sinful man on earth, and that man can do something to repair this relationship on his own part, and some it's repaired and some it's not, over 80 to 90% it's not repaired by anybody's guesstimation based on evangelical Christianity. And then, of course, you have just that many on the other end of this, the heaven and the hell issue of it. You have hell being overly populated and heaven very sparsely populated. Barris, the glorified suffering that you're bringing up and these holy acts, we can go to the extreme end of this where people are flailing themselves with whips, and we can actually back up and look at this in the daily life of many Christians in the U.S. and around the world. Do you remember when the Word of Faith movement came along? The thing that they parted the Red Sea for us for is that everything that is good is God, and everything that's bad is the devil. In fact, that was during I came up with bumper stickers, and one of my bumper stickers said, "Good God, bad devil." And that was the great revelation that, you know, if something good happened to you, I remember standing in front of people saying, my life is so simple. Why is it simple, Brother Mike? Because I've got this line that I draw right down the middle of my life. There's a line across the top. And at the top, I've got on the left side, it says God, and on the right side, it says devil. Everything that happens in my life, I can put on one side of that line or the other.
Dualism.
Dualism it's on steroids. I thought I was making progress, but all it was organizing my dualism.
Oh, you were the best organized dualist around, I guess.
Oh, I was. Man, if you're going to have dualism, organize it. You'll make money. Everybody's trapped there. None of it's working, and you're explaining how it will work. You're explaining how a system that has never worked will work.
And because between now and when you return next year, no one will have made it work, they'll want you to come back and tell them what they missed first time. God, exactly. I love it. What a money machine.
So here the Word of Faith movement comes along after 2,000 years, and now they've got the answer as to how to make dualism work. And that's what I was preaching. Man, everything was either God or the devil. But, you know, one of our counterparts in that doctrine was, especially in Catholicism, was glorified suffering. They believed that when they had cancer, that it was for Christ. They were suffering for Christ. And this is glorified suffering. So you have these extremes to where that sickness is of the devil, to the other extreme that sickness is of God, that it's pure, that sickness is a holy and divine thing. And on the other side of the spectrum of this dualism, you have to come up with that sickness is completely of the devil. Not that sickness is sickness, not of God nor of the devil. God forbid that we ever resolve that sickness comes from germs and disorders and faulty hearts and blah, blah, blah. No, it's got to be God or the devil. So, you know, I landed on the side that this was not God. Bless God, and we're going to resist it. We're going to curse it. We're going to command it to come out. So what little Catholic women were embracing as an act of God, we were rebuking and cursing as an act of the devil.
That was my failing when I was young, you know.
Young Catholic women, I'm beginning to catch on.
You got there eventually, didn't you?
I really did. Quicker than ever before, too. Oh my, that means my brain is falling into some state that I don't want it to go. God forbid when we start understanding one another, right?
So quickly. Mike, as you were just talking, I was jotting down some notes and thinking of different ways that this glorified suffering thing attacks us, especially when you said that in the Word of Faith movement, there is one outlook. In other movements, there's other outlooks, but there is one outlook which seems to permeate a lot of denominational thinking, and that is that God sends us suffering, be it financial suffering, be it, which is usually our own stupidity, or be it physical suffering in the form of a sickness, but God sends us these things in order to improve us, somehow to drive the dross out and let the gold rise as pure God material to the top some. And this thing is, it's put into prose and poetry and song, and it's worshipped as something which is to be, dare I say, even believed.
When you can't explain nor accept something that's happening in your life that's negative, like you said, whether it's financial, physical. I mean, goodness, that's how most people get through divorces. You finally just label your mate as the devil and God's trying to deliver you from them. Mm-hmm. You know, something has to justify our actions is why that we do this glorified suffering thing, because we don't know that we don't need justification, that that has already taken place through the blood of Christ. And so we look for justification. We look for justification for being sick. We look for justification for failure. We look for justification on every level. And only the gospel can alleviate this. Please let me, let's continually remind ourselves, folks, that as we talk about these things, there is one single remedy for all of this, and it is called the gospel. That is good news to the entire human race, not just to a few. But we do assign all of those things that it's either the devil or that it's God trying to teach you. You know, well, the Lord's trying to teach you something. And I remember when I began to bring this thinking into question in my own life, and it just started sounding nonsensical to me. Michael, have you stopped to think what the Lord's trying to teach you?
And of course, in that scenario, you're the one who's at fault.
Exactly. There's already fault there. So, and if you have any problems in your life, you are at fault. Because we know God's good. We know God giveth liberally to everyone that asketh. So if there's something that's the wrongeth, then it's the mattereth is with youth. So, yeah, so this self-examination begins, which is a bottomless pit, as we all found out. It's just an absolutely bottomless pit. And that's where the gospel turns this thing inside out. We stop looking for what's wrong with us. Why did we stop? Is it because we don't want to know what's wrong with us? No, it's because it's an endless search. You're always going to find out things that's wrong with you, but finding them out isn't going to necessarily give you the ability to change these things. The gospel perspective is to look at yourself through the eyes of God, and your perspective of yourself will change. And if anything needs to be changed, it'll change it. Otherwise, goodness gracious, let's stop this battling with ourselves. And especially from this situation, Barrister, like what we're talking about now, of having to blame God, you know, for the things that are happening in our lives because we have no other way to justify what's happening. We're taught that the only thing else we can do is accept blame, that there's something spiritually wrong with us, and the only way we can escape out from under that heavy blanket is to say, no, 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 there's nothing wrong with me. The thing is, God's simply refining me. God is teaching me something.
I think justification, self-justification, God-justification, justification of our own beliefs is definitely part of it. But it's the lazy person's way of trying to understand why what is happening is happening. And then, of course, the moment you do that, you've backed yourself into a doctrinal corner out of which you've got no recourse except to flail yourself, to blame yourself, to pray your way out of it, to humble your way, whatever it is. It's something you're going to have to do.
Yes, and again, it falls right back on the individual and leaving Christ out completely. We've fallen from grace, Ferris. We've done despite to the Spirit of grace. We've insulted the Spirit of grace.
And God knows if you're in that low position, Christ, you're going to have to dig yourself out before Christ even going to hear you.
Yes, exactly. Because we do know that God doesn't hear everybody's prayers. He hears everybody's prayers and answers everybody's prayers that does everything right. But, boy, you know, if you get something wrong, then God's not going to hear your prayers.
Or if you have unconfessed sin in your life, if we were to get our brains around that one, Mike,
yeah,
we could once and for all get out of our mindset, get away from the damning paradigm,
yeah,
that we have anything the heck to do with our salvation. Look, if you have anything to do with your salvation, if you did anything to get your salvation, you can lose it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say that again. If you did anything with getting salvation, then you can lose it the same way. This is what gives me great confidence. Great, great confidence. Is I know that I had nothing to do with my own change, my own salvation, and therefore I can do nothing to lose it. I mean, how good is that, Mike?
That's good stuff, good news. You know, I don't think that in our lifetime, Barris, we will ever come to grips with the deadliness of daily confession of sins.
If nothing else, it just takes up a bunch of time you could be reading a good book.
Number one, and if you actually believe that it's doing something, it can be deadly to your way of thinking. You self-sabotage and everything else.
Mm.
Like you said, if we are just tried to wrap our minds around that one subject, let's try to wrap our minds around it on both sides. Let's say you do have to do that. Number one, to confess all of your sins, your transgressions of the law. Number one, you have to know all of the law.
Oh, and you have to know all of your sins.
And that's knowing all your laws is the only way you can know all your sins.
Only if you got a good memory.
And then you have to have a really good memory. And then you have to transpose that to Jesus' teaching that says it's not just if you did it, it's if you even thought about it.
Oh, I thought about it. Believe me. Remember those young Catholic women?
No, I'm trying to forget, actually. Before we descend into a place we cannot recover ourselves. See, if we did not have these exemption clauses, the only thing I would like for people to do who profess that the law is still in effect is stick to it. Stick to it. You know, do the law. No, and
be consistent.
Be consistent and do what the law says. Don't ever. The moment that you judge somebody else by the law, you've broken all of God's law. The law was only given for you to judge yourself. My gosh. Let's not try to reform Christianity at all. If we could just get people to do that, stop judging others, just use it to judge yourself. What a revolution that would bring.
And judging yourself has nothing to do with absolving yourself, confessing and getting forgiveness. It's got to do with, so I'm broken too, huh?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, then the pot kind of has to stop calling the kettle black, so to speak.
Now, I've divided this glorified suffering up into two areas. I did it while you were chatting. Because you gave me the idea, Mike, and that is active voluntary suffering and passive involuntary suffering. Passive involuntary suffering being that which Mike's already just covered, and that is the fact that many people say that the reason that they're sick is not because the flu was going around or not because they've eaten the wrong foods all their lives and now have cancer, but it was because God's trying to teach them something or refine them. So that is passive involuntary suffering, and we'll come back and touch partly on that in a little while, but let's start with active voluntary suffering. That is where we put ourselves into the lion's mouth in order to prove
exactly
what godly people we are.
Well, even Lent. Isn't that what Lent is? Voluntary suffering?
I don't get Lent.
That's because you got a Lent brush.
A Lent?
That's what people do Lent for. What are you going to, quote, give up for Lent? What are you going to give up?
Ramadan is the same.
Yes, Ramadan is the same. These develop into mental disorders, Barris.
How could they be them?
They develop into mental disorders because of dualism. It splits the brain right in two.
Between
sinner and saint. You don't even know who you are anymore. This is the area of the human being where you need to be coming to grips with who you are.
I remember being told time and again the reason I was sick was because I had sin in my life.
Yes.
It was just that simple. There was no deep thinking involved.
No, not a thing.
Mm.
And the mental illness that can lead to. You know, people have asked me, they said, well, does it always lead to mental illness? Only in those who really believe it.
Ah, yes.
Now, for those of us that really believed it, we became mentally ill. Thank God for those who sat through church and just thought, well, yeah, oh, praise the Lord, and went on about their business. But there was those of us who didn't just say, oh, well, praise the Lord and go on about our business. This became our business. This is what we did.
We lived. We lived and we died for
it. We lived it. And we did die for it. That is for sure. Everything came to a death, as that always does. It always leads to death. And it destroyed everything in many people's lives. And that's why we're on here doing this, folks. I guarantee that most every one of our listeners right now, the gospel revolutionaries especially, have come to grips with the losses incurred by religious thinking such as this. They've absorbed the losses. They have taken that in. They've acknowledged the fact that they were fools, that we were fools. We were fooled, and we fooled a lot of people. But you can only be fooled and be a fool for just so long. And it finally breaks down, Barris. It's like a bad form of logic that sticks together as long as it's short-term memory.
I remember talking to somebody, and it was about their suffering, and they were absolute in their belief that God had sent them suffering. It was in the form of the death of their son in a harvester. He got caught up in a harvester on a farm. A kid was 3 or 4 years old. And you just say to yourself, how do you say that God brought this evil upon me? And how do you do it with a straight face? And I realized, as I was talking to this lady, I was talking to her in the hospital as the boy was brought in. And I realized there was a part of her mind that she had compartmentalized and shut off from the real world and was living in there. I said to her, you do know, don't you, that God did not cause this grief to come upon your family? She said, no, he did. Now, she never told me why she thought that was so, you know, had the husband had been doing something wrong, had she been doing something wrong? She just said that for some reason, God had orchestrated the mangling, bloodied death of their son in a cold, hard steel machine.
And tell me that doesn't create mental illness.
Oh, my God.
We thought we were doing better. All the Word of Faith movement did is take dualism and switch to emphasizing the other side. And we went from glorified suffering to demonized suffering.
That's well put.
And folks, let me tell you, one of the many, many things I'm so thankful for is I still suffer occasionally, just like I did before it was God doing it and before it was the devil doing it, long after, actually, both of those. I still go through suffering the same way that I did at times. But now I only have to deal with the suffering. What a horrible thing to get a cold and have to figure out what sin you're in, you know, to be diagnosed with cancer and try to figure out what God's trying to teach you. This is mental illness. It just is nothing short of it. But it is a glorious thing. There's times, Barris, when I'm going through a tough time that I remind myself what I'm not going through. Oh, my. And right in the middle of my suffering, I get excited. Because I realized, my God, there was a time in my life when I tried to figure out what God was trying to tell me. Why was God doing this to me? Man, I'm telling you, I went from a drastic swing of glorified suffering to demonized suffering to just suffering. I don't want anybody to suffer. But when you stop and realize what, because of the gospel, you're not going through. Barris, it never crosses my mind at all when difficulty hits my life. It is not any longer even a part of the thought process when anything happens as to think, why did God do this or how did the devil do this? None of that enters my brain at all. And I'm so grateful for it.
Well, it's taking responsibility for our actions instead of blaming God or expecting some works that I do. Okay, let's have a look at active voluntary suffering as opposed to passive involuntary suffering. The first word that comes to mind is that of a martyr. This person or that person died as a martyr for their beliefs and so forth. Now, this word is used umpteen times, or actually umpteen and a half times in the New Testament, and every single time it's used, except two.
Yep.
It is translated as witness.
Mind-blowing.
Isn't it? Yeah. The word in Greek is martus, and the only two times that it was translated as martyr was A, in the martyr's crown, in Revelation, and B, the death of Stephen, who died as a martyr.
And even then, we use the term martyr for Stephen because of the word it has become, not because of the word that it was and always was until it was changed. Which Barris is going to tell us about how all that little trick took place. You know, why should we have not been suspect? This is such a religious word. Why should we not have been suspect that this word somehow became at least conflated to mean what they say it means, if not just totally made up? And what we actually found, Barris, is that it was just totally made up.
Well, yes. Now, let me first give you a reading of this word, and we're going to go to 1 Peter 5, verse 1. This is Peter, the Apostle Peter, describing himself. And he wants to make sure that those who are hearing him understand that he comes with some measure of authority. And he writes this, "The elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder." In other words, I want to exhort you elders, and I also am an elder, and a witness of the sufferings of Christ. That word witness is martyr, or in Greek, martus. Now, you'll notice he's still alive, Michael.
Yes, that's what a witness is. You got to be a witness.
But apparently, somewhere, this word martyr, and it's a very interesting process how this happens. I read about this some time ago, and there's a name in logic and in literature for it, and I can't quite remember what it is. But what happens is we take a modern term and put that back on an ancient term, changing thereby the meaning of the ancient term. The ancient term meant witness. Go to court, you're a witness. All of these people are alive. Peter, in 1 Peter 5, 1, he's alive and he says, I'm a witness. I'm a martus. All of these people are exactly the same Greek word. So somewhere between the Greek and the English, this word got a little bit screwed up. It shouldn't come as any surprise that it happened in the Latin. So let's see what the online etymology dictionary says. Old English martyr, from late Latin martyr, from Doric Greek martyr, earlier martis or martus. In Christian use, martyr, literally witness, and it goes on to give you the Greek derivation. We see here that the changes all occurred in or just before Middle English, and they all occurred in the Latin, to be precise. Now, the Latin's a language preferred by the church to A, interpret as they see, as the church sees fit, B, hide from the common people, that's why they call it the Dark Ages, hide from the common people the real sense of it. Remember that the Catholic Church had no Bible until the Douay Rheims in English, which was 1,500 years after the birth of Christ. So 1,500 years after the birth of Christ, the Catholic Church decided that the common people could be given the Bible in their own language. Before that, translators were killed. They were martyred, so to speak, if you'll forgive the joke there. So simply what has happened, Michael, is in the Greek, martyr means witness. It meant witness. It never didn't mean witness. It's always meant witness. But as the Bible got printed, by that time, martyr had come to mean somebody who dies for something they believe in. Then that was put back into the Bible, superimposed over the Greek word martus as a witness. Now it meant somebody who died for what they believed in.
Wow. I turned it on its head because part of the original Latin did give vent to being a witness of sufferings. Was that still in the Latin that, Greek that it's, gives definition of being a witness of suffering?
It could do, but only if suffering was also mentioned in the same breath.
As far as context.
Correct.
So the very closest you could get to suffering and being a martyr is someone who watched suffering take place. So everybody who's claiming to be a martyr who died are not martyrs. It's those of us who watched it.
So what you're saying is when Stephen became a quote-unquote martyr,
yep,
it was actually the people like Paul standing around holding the coats of those who were stoning him. They were the real martyrs. They were the real witnesses.
So we are the martyrs of this generation, actually, and when you start looking at it, you know, what if this word had remained what it was truly given, the definition of the meaning? I'm just a stickler for this definition of words. I know a lot of people who experience any kind of evolution in their thoughts about Christianity want to develop a new vocabulary. I want to go back and redeem the vocabulary that was there, Barris. And this is one of those glaring situations that we've walked off and left this rubble here when we could have stayed behind and started picking up these pieces and helping people understand this. What a drastic difference. A martyr is not the one who suffered. The martyr is the one who watched the suffering, just like it said in the verse that you used. That Peter said that he was a witness of the suffering of Christ.
Mm.
And so when you watch these things take place, so now what would these people do if there was no such word as martyr? That they are trying to achieve martyrdom. And look how it has evolved from there to having all kinds of rewards for being a martyr. And that pulled out of literally one single verse out of the book of Revelation. That's the only place that gives any rewards to a mistranslated word. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. But what the Latin Bible took up was simply what they had inherited from the early church, and to be fair about them. Let's have a look at a couple of early people. Now, there was a fellow called Ignatius. No, let's go straight to the bloke who made martyr his last name. Well, the church made it his title, and that would be Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr lived from around about 100. So if other records can be relied on, he lived from just after the death of the Apostle John to around about 165. We can be certain of his death because of people who were reigning at the time. Most of his writings are lost now. He was a teacher. He converted to Christianity, and he had a very universal outlook. He claimed that people like Socrates and Plato were Christians because of the way they thought, not because of anything else, but just because of the way they thought. It was quite interesting. Some of his writings are still around. He got beheaded and is now considered to be a saint of the Roman Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, and the Eastern Orthodox Church. So he has some standing in a large section of Christianity. He was called Justin. We don't know what his last name is, but now we know him as Justin Martyr. And as early as 165 AD, now that is only 100 years after Peter wrote what he wrote. It's only probably, 70 or 80 years after John wrote about martyrs in Revelation, or witnesses in Revelation. And by that time, now martyrdom meant what it has meant today. So it happened very, very quickly. And I believe we can prove that it happened at the instigation of John. But we'll have a look at that in Revelation in a moment. Now, there was another fella called Ignatius. Now, Ignatius, I think Ignatius the idiot, Saint Idiot, I would rather call him. Ignatius had a death wish. He was considered a holy man. He was born about the time that about 35 AD. He was born when Jesus was probably just a couple of years after Jesus died. And he became a bishop a long way away from Rome. And at one stage, he decided, he'd come to the conclusion that the only way he could get the martyr's crown, which John talked about, was, and there's every reason to think that he was highly influenced by John, possibly a student of John. The only way he could actually get that was by literally throwing himself into the lion's mouth. He said, on the way to Rome, he wrote several letters. None of them are in the Bible now, but he wrote several letters, and we get a really interesting glimpse into early church life through his letters. But one of them he wrote to the Church of Rome, and he said, "I beg you, do not try to save me." Now, the church in Rome had some pretty influential people in it, including, I mean, when Paul writes to the Romans, he talks about someone called Rufus in chapter 16, which is his half-brother, living with a captive of Rome, namely Caractacus, King Caractacus, who was a king of the Britons, who'd been taken to Rome, found guilty of everything, dragged up the main streets in chains as they did, put into the Senate so that the Senate could then condemn him to death. And as Tacitus, I think it was, said, he gave such a moving speech that they gave him his life and a lifetime stipend that he got from the taxes of his own kingdom back from Britain. And he did that in a rather palatial surroundings with his family at his side. His daughter married Rufus, who was a half-brother of Paul. So when Paul is talking in Romans in chapter 16, he's talking about this fellow called Rufus. What the hell am I talking about, and how did I get here?
I don't know, Barris. How did you get there, and what are you talking about?
Gosh, I wish I could play that back. Ignatius wrote to this same church. That's where we are. So the point is that this same church, the Church of Rome, had some fairly influential people associated with it, both Gentiles and Jews. Ignatius writes, on the way to being taken to Rome under a Roman guard, he says, he begs that church, he says, "Do not try and save me, for I would that my bones be ground between the teeth of the lions as the wheat is turned into bread, so that I might gain my martyr's crown." He just discovered a payoff for suicide. And so I call him Ignatius' idiot. But time and time again after that, we find these very early, this man Ignatius, he died before Justin Martyr. By the time Justin Martyr came along, it wasn't now just a happenstance. It wasn't now just a byline, a story. Now it was a trend. So they had to have a name for the trend, and they called him Justin Martyr.
So the guy who really started using this the first time, he used the term martyr's crown by having his bones ground by the teeth of the lion as wheat. But isn't that what the Book of Revelation says about? Is it martyr's crown that where he got this from?
The martyr's crown was taken from Revelation 2:10. Fear none of those things which shall you'll suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you might be tried, that you might have tribulation for 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Now, the other time when this is mentioned, Peter says, "And when the chief shepherd shall appear, you shall receive a crown of glory that fades not away."
What is the verse in Revelation that uses the term martyr? What kind of reward is that talking about?
Revelation 2:13 talks about Antipas was my faithful martyr who was slain among you where Satan dwells. It indicates death and faithfulness in the same breath, but the word should be witness to one church, which is the church at Smyrna. He talks about a crown of life. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. That's where the martyr's crown has come from. And just a couple of breaths later, I know your works, to another church, the church of Pergamos, You have not denied my faith even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr or witness who was slain among you. John has definitely got this concept that violent death associated with faithfulness must be rewarded with a crown.
And be rewarded in heaven, too. John's other invention, people going to heaven.
It can't be rewarded in heaven either. Well, that's a couple of weeks away. We're going to be talking about that. This is interesting stuff. So, where does that leave us? Let's get back on track. That was Justin Martyr and Ignatius. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the Fox's Book of Martyrs. Fox's Book of Martyrs was a book written by Protestants for Protestants in order to remember how bad Catholics are. And it contains story after story of European people who died because they didn't agree with the Catholic Church. Then we come to modern day in the Philippines. You have these people who sometimes die crucifying themselves in order to win brownie points with God. It's essentially a Catholic kind of a ritual. And then you have in the Islamic world, people who, either for love of God, love of 70 virgins, or whatever they do, they become a martyr by strapping bombs to themselves and blowing themselves up and killing a whole bunch of other people. So this is all in the area of active voluntary suffering. We can keep going into the monastic lifestyle, celibate priests, nuns, monks, hermits, ascetics. The Desert Fathers were a bunch of guys who in the first 100 years of the church used to go out and sit on a flagpole for 30 years until they died. They were served their food on the flagpole by a stick, and we have to ask ourselves, where did this come from? I just want to read a couple of Bible verses. James, Peter, and John instructed Paul to feed the widows and the poor. And John in Revelation describes this crown that is associated with what later became known as martyrdom. Listen to what Paul says, though. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profits me nothing. Now, James says faith without works is dead. Paul says faith without love is dead.
Yeah.
He writes, and though I am all faith, and I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains. Now he's calling on that phrase that Jesus used, but have no love, I'm nothing. Now, why I refer to these verses is Paul had very different outlook as far as dying than James, Peter, and John seem to.
Really? Yes.
Paul saw no value at all in dying. Though I give my body to be burned and don't have love, profits me nothing. He says I'd rather go home, whatever home is.
No spiritual value in death at all that Paul gives.
Doesn't seem to be, Mike.
That's incredible. And should we be surprised with the difference of the doctrines that these guys preach? Wouldn't their views on everything be different? I mean, here Peter, James, and John glorify suffering and glorify death, and Paul says, yeah.
And everything that Paul says reflects this. I'll, to be absent from the body, I'll be present with the Lord. I'd rather go home, but I want to stay with you because you need me more. And here, even if I'm burnt, even if I willfully give my body to be burned and have not charity, profits me nothing.
Yeah.
Martyrdom means nothing. There ain't no crown associated with it.
Mm.
John says, no, there's got to be something good in the sweet by and by, because what the hell is all the suffering worth? Well, I mean, what's it? And you can understand a very human mind saying that, Mike, yeah. Can't you?
What's the suffering all about? But what's the suffering all about? But what's the suffering all about?
Bringing you back to the title of today's show, and that is Holy Acts, Glorified Suffering. And it's not just, look, glorified suffering. We could talk about Amish people, German Brethren people, Mennonite people, people who they suffer the deprivations of modern technology because they believe that they're going to be better off because of it, both in this life and in the next. And then what do we say about people who spend the whole night praying on their knees doing without food for lengthy periods of time so that their bodies are waste. People who submit themselves to punishments by other people so that their sins may be totally eradicated. Priests who used to whip themselves. Martin Luther, who climbed up the multiple stairs of the church steps in the city where he lived on broken glass. What do we say about that? Did it bring them any closer to God?
Well, and the thing of it is that Paul would have referred to all of that as a direct offense to God's grace. If you still think that there is a need for chastening and suffering for glorification, self-imposed or God-imposed, you've fallen from grace. You're insulting the grace of God. You're saying that the suffering of Christ was not sufficient, that the death of Christ was not sufficient. That's why we had to come up with martyrdom, because in martyrdom, you have to have no respect for the death of Christ, the claim of martyrdom. We're not talking about people who have had this term misapplied to them, who died for noble causes. Goodness gracious, there are noble ways to put your life on the line for something. But people who pursue it, because the eventuality of it is, according to the book of Revelation, not only is it Islam that has great rewards for people who are martyred, but Christianity, the highest rewards. I mean, it's like playing Monopoly, and you get to pass all the way around the board. You know, you get free parking. You know, it's suddenly all of the rules don't apply. Think about that, Barris. Suddenly, in martyrdom, none of the rules that confine my life to sin and righteousness, none of them apply in martyrdom. All of that's wiped out. It is a straight shoot upward. It's, you get caught in the updraft, and then it doesn't make any difference whether you've been a whoremonger or lustful or caused pain and suffering. And in the process, to where that gets so perverted that the causing of pain and suffering in your death is the highest form of martyrdom.
And sometimes the more the suffering, the more glorious the martyrdom.
Yes, and not just the suffering of the quote martyr, which we found out is a complete fabrication, but also the suffering of the people that is inflicted upon. That's a reward for you.
This is what happened. Origen, he was an early church father. In fact, Origen was the church father who more than anyone else influenced the later church. Really including Augustine. He was later declared a heretic. He was a universalist. He was concurrent with the Emperor Constantine. His father was a Christian. He was hauled off, and Origen wanted to go and die in the service of freeing his father, but his father died an alleged martyr's death. And in his own life, he decided that in order to remain loyal to God and to remain singly focused, single-eyed, about serving the church, he had to castrate himself. He did that himself. And he held that out to be a reason for suffering in the name of Jesus. Me, I'm just a man. I'm just a normal man. I don't quite get that.
Goodness. He thinks that people... oh, my gosh. You say, well, why are you laughing, Mike? Well, the other choice is cry. This is horrible, Barris. And yet this mindset, even though many of these extremes are isolated now to just one group of people, but the mindset is still here.
If it was right back then, why shouldn't we be actively looking for martyrdom now? Exactly. Surely we'd get a crown.
Yes. And but we've narrowed the scope of quote martyrdom. And Islam has broadened the scope of martyrdom to fit more of what our scope used to be in Christianity.
There are many, many forms of glorified suffering, and every religion has their own version of it. You want to sit on a pole in the desert? That's one. You want to walk from here to Rome? That's another. Or you make the pilgrimage That's another. You purposely do harm to your own body. That's another. If you don't get these, if you believe that suffering, in passive involuntary suffering, helps you come closer to God in any way whatsoever, you should really wonder, if you die in good health, why the hell you missed out and God didn't think enough of you. But all of these have one thing in common, and that is the belief that the infliction of pain upon one's self is something which brings one closer to God. Now, Michael, what was the source of this?
Well, if you're trying to get closer to God, Barris, it's obvious you have a concept that God is apart from you. All of these are attempts to close the gap. Oh my God, did I ever get tired of that phraseology in the Word of Faith movement, closing the gap and filling the gap. And
well, how about this? Oh. This is the one that got me. Press into Jesus.
Oh,
like what's yes. What's that look like?
I know, exactly. Oh my gosh, the lunacy of this. So here you have, obviously, if somebody thinks that suffering gets them closer to God, it is the disease of dualism in their mind. It's a disease. And the mind is diseased when it has dualism, and it causes you not to use basic logic. Folks, I tell you, we've got to double down on our efforts to sharing this gospel with this planet, because the suffering that people are going through that is being exacerbated by the thoughts that this is God, or I'm doing it for God, or the devil, either one, and the suffering that it is really inflicting on the lives of other people in pursuit of their own holiness and pursuit of their own crowns in heaven or rewards in heaven. There's nobody else talking about the heart of this issue.
Come to think of it, if there wasn't any payoff, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Wouldn't be having the discussion. So we're not only saying that God's not passing out sufferings, God's not passing out rewards. Our reward is Christ. Why is that not enough? Especially for Christians. Why is Christ not enough of a reward? He says that we are his reward. Why is he satisfied with us being his reward? Why are not we satisfied with him being ours? Did Jesus get back? Did Jesus say, wow, man, when I get done with all of this, you know, if we're going to have mansions in heaven, where in the world does Jesus live? Wow, that's got to be a knockout place. Talk about reward. He must be dripping with gold. Gold streets. His toilet must be of gold.
Well, let's see where he lives, shall we?
Well, that would be nice. It's got to be glorious and grand, though, Barris.
I guess it must be. You know, there is one chapter in the Bible that talks about this. Jesus says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house are many mansions. If it was not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, you will be with me." Mm. Well, let's see where that was. Let's go down in this same chapter, John 14, to the only other place where that word mansions is used. Used nowhere else in this chapter. Verse 23, Jesus said, "If a man loves me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him." That word abode is the same as mansions. Hang on. Hold up here.
Yeah, mansion for a mansion. He is our reward, and we are his. That's what he's saying. He has made us his mansion.
Oh boy,
and he is ours. That's the amazing thing here, Barris, is that there's not levels of reward. This levels of reward in heaven is so devastating to the heart and the mind of the people of planet Earth. And God is no longer a punisher, and God is not a rewarder. Why? Oh my, you're taking my rewards. I just don't understand Christians wanting something more than Christ. I don't get it. We go around preaching that Christ is the all in all, but we want something more when we die, other than just Jesus. I don't get it. My gosh. Whatever the life after this one is, place or not, I know it's in Christ, and I know it's Christ in me, and I know it's me and you in each other. And never shall this ever be alienated or separated. This is a work that has been completed. We have got to allow the gospel to rip out of our conscious thinking and our subconscious thinking the issue of our actions bringing punishment from God or letting the devil in, or reward from God. Goodness gracious, when that scenario would break down and we'd see bad people getting good things, you remember how we dealt with that, Barris? Oh, that's the devil blessing him. the devil's blessing him for obeying him. It's like, then how the hell do you tell the difference? If the blessings that God gives is the same blessings the devil gives if you serve, and the issue is service, then what? Why are we worried about blessings anyway? Why are we worried about rewards? If either the devil or God, either one's going to give them to us if we just give dedicated service, then the issue should be who is God, not this dualism of choosing between God and the devil. It all has its same roots. This subject of dualism, we're going to be covering it again in Canada, so make sure you get your tickets. Seats are limited.
And so, family, we have talked about holy beliefs. Let me tell you, the only holy belief that is around was when God believed in you. Mm. We've talked about holy wars. Yes, there was a holy war.
Yep.
But it was fought over you. Are there holy places? You bet there are.
Mm-hmm.
You. Is there a holy people? Yes. You. And what was the greatest holy act ever completed? It was you.
Mm.
You're a new creation. So am I. We're all new creations. And you, not God, you, were the focus of everything that we read in the scriptures, because you are in Jesus. Jesus is in God. You are in Jesus. And the focus was always about you. Jesus may have been the person, and indeed was, who made it happen. But you are the third-party beneficiary.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. This is great stuff. And we're going to be back next week talking about heaven and hell. You don't want to miss that, because
we got to talk about heaven and hell.
Yeah, and we plan to be pretty controversial about it, too. Don't forget, I've just upped my offer to $2,000 now. If anyone can show me where antinomianism appears in any of the earliest or any of the any single document, which is a Greek manuscript of the Bible, Latin, doesn't bother, I don't care what language it's in, previous to 1500, I'll give you $2,000. And I want you to remember what Robert Ingersoll said: this crime called blasphemy was invented by priests for the purpose of defending doctrines not able to take care of themselves. So, remember that religion wants to downsize your expectations, outsource your thinking, and repurpose your existence. But God's eternal plan was only and always to enjoy the heck out of you and all of your uniqueness. And so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. Don't forget to visit www.onemikewilliams.com and get your copy of Mike's book, One, The Gospel According to Mike. In there, Mike lays out the gospel in simple, straightforward language and weaves it with stories from his own personal experiences, which lead him to the place of ultimate ease where he now lives. Hardcover, $27, paperback, $15, Kindle edition, $3, and a whole 3 cents. A dollar a week is nothing really, but here at the Gospel Revolution, it can make all the difference for someone just like you, starting their own journey towards thinking for themselves. We run a value-for-value model here, and if you feel that you've received real value from this podcast, then I'm asking you to seriously consider donating a buck a week or a buck a day. Why don't you just call our office on area code 321-220-4373 and speak to Jeffrey Robertson about how you can participate, or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the donate link. Perhaps you'd like to invite Mike to your area? It is easier than you might think. Call our office on the number we just mentioned with details, when, where, and why, and we will make that happen for you. You want to leave a message for Mike or a question for him to answer? Dial area code 234-564-0971. Leave us a voicemail. You can find us on Facebook at Friends of Mike Williams and the Gospel Revolution. Thanks to Marcel Roos in the Netherlands. All the gospel all the time is being broadcast 24/7 at myradiostream.com/gospelrevolution. So now it's good night from myself, Beres Bartlett, from the GR Studios in Music City, USA, Nashville, Tennessee.
And it's good night from Michael Williams, still here in Houston, Texas at the moment. We love you guys. Thank you so much. We are going to continue sharing this gospel with this planet. Can you think of anything else more needed? The conversation that we've had today is one of the most needed conversations on this planet at this point, at this time in history, and in the lives of people around this planet. I will guarantee you there is no other topic more important, but pertinent every day. What's going on right now in the world? There's no one dealing with it on this level other than the Gospel Revolution. Be proud of where your money's going, folks. You see what we do with it. We love you so much.
Don't forget that Michael and I will be in Calgary, Canada, around about the 23rd of next month. And we're going to have a ball up there. We hope that you enjoy it with us. We're going to make ourselves available to you, not just to teach and to share what we have learned, but also just to enjoy fellowship with people who are of like mind. We hope you enjoyed today's PowerCast, but if you didn't, remember, just because you're offended does not mean you're right. So if you prefer learning how to think to being told what to think, join us again next week, same time, same channel.
Where we are going to do the same thing. You got to fill in the blank now.
All over.
Oh, that didn't work, Beres.
I don't like working with people who can't do what they're told. We're going to do the same thing all over again. Bound to be better, though.
It's going to be better.